another all-nighter on Capitol Hill. I'm Pam Puso, Fox News. The Senate is still voting on hundreds of amendments to a nearly $2 trillion coronavirus relief bill that appears poised to pass. Late last night, a logjam over extending unemployment benefits was broken after Senate leaders and moderate Democrat Joe Manchin struck a deal.
Manchin has agreed to an extra $300 of unemployment benefits through September. Democrats and President Biden need Manchin's vote to pass the bill. Biden backs this agreement. But potential changes could be a problem in the House if the bill tilts away from liberal priorities.
Fox's Chad Pergram, yesterday an attempt to raise the minimum wage fell short. Dual investigations into New York Governor Andrew Cuomo are moving forward. The state attorney general has reportedly told his office to preserve any documentation related to a sexual harassment probe. Also being looked at, the governor's handling of coronavirus deaths among nursing home patients.
The Wall Street Journal essentially saying that Cuomo's top aide somehow convinced state health officials to alter nursing home data to only count deaths that occurred inside those facilities and not patients who died after being taken to the hospital. Now, the governor's office has responded to this report. They said they did that because at that time they could not verify those out-of-facility numbers.
Fox's Aisha Hosni, the governor has rejected repeated calls for his resignation. Peaceful coexistence, that's the message being sent in Iraq by Pope Francis and the country's top Shiite cleric who met today in Najaf. Both leaders are urging Muslims to embrace Iraq's Christian minority. Security forces in Burma are again using tear gas and stun grenades on protesters. It's been more than a month since the military toppled the government. America's listening to Fox News. As the number of migrants spikes at our southern border, the U.S. is said to be considering housing unaccompanied children in Virginia.
The Pentagon has not yet received a formal request, but Reuters is reporting unaccompanied migrant kids may soon be headed for a military base near Richmond, Virginia. HHS tells us HHS will continue to utilize all available options to safely care for the children referred to us. These options include both short-term and long-term solutions.
Fox's Peter Ducey. Since taking office, President Biden has sought to dismantle his predecessor's immigration policy. Many Republicans are now urging him to reinstate a national emergency declaration for the southern border. Baseball fans in California will have the chance to hear the crack of the bat in person. Starting on April 1st, which happens to be Major League Baseball's opening day, California will allow people to attend baseball games and other sporting events in limited capacities. Disneyland is also planning to reopen. As for all the headlines about people leaving California over the past year, they weren't entirely accurate.
During the pandemic, the flight of well-known people like Joe Rogan and Elon Musk out of California fueled speculation that many others might do the same. But the data shows they did not. Fewer people did move into California, but there was no mass exodus out of the state, according to the California Policy Lab, which looked at credit data, to discover that people moved more within the state. For example, San Francisco County saw a large number of people move out. Net exits from the county increased just under 650%, but two-thirds of them just moved to other Bay Area counties, and most stayed in state. As for the state as a whole, roughly the same number who left moved in until the fourth quarter, when about twice as many left as entered.
Fox's Jessica Rosenthal. I'm Pam Puso, Fox News.
Here is the latest traffic report. In Alexandria, there is construction work going on 395 southbound at King Street. Keep this in mind. 395 express lanes are pointing in the southbound direction. On the southbound side of 395 express lanes in Alexandria, right at King Street, there's road construction. Left lane is blocked. In Centerville on 66 westbound, there's construction. Roadway reduced down to one lane between the Fairfax County Parkway and 28. And in 66 westbound in Centerville at 28, there is construction going on. Be sure to follow the detour around that construction site.
Now, the Saturday morning update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf is behind the console. Jane Houghton and our producer this morning. And the Senate continues its voting marathon In the 6 o'clock hour of a Saturday morning, they've been at it all night. There was a long delay yesterday, and that followed a long delay to start things off. But the Senate has reached a deal. The voting continues, but they seem to have a deal that will move the president's $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package forward. And a lot of criticism, a lot of back and forth, obviously, between Republicans and Democrats. It all kind of started off with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson. Now, he forced the Senate clerks to read the new version of the whole bill. 635 pages, took over 10 hours. Here's how he explained why he did it.
I sat on the floor of the Senate. I listened to the entire 11 hours. What we would have been doing is we would have gone to Votorama last night. No time to read the bill, no time to really prepare.
So that was Ron Johnson as to why he had the bill read to begin with. Then they began the Votorama. That's what they're calling it, began yesterday at 11.03 a.m. No votes had been taken as of 6.15. There have been amendment votes overnight. They continue in session this morning on the floor of the Senate. Now, what happened in terms of the breakthrough? What's been going on? Well, Joe Manchin has become the man in Washington. There was about a nine-hour delay that followed Manchin's resistance to an earlier agreement on jobless payments. Now, the party leaders did announce a new accord with Manchin. The deal, as it stands now, that Manchin is signing off on, would provide $300 a week in extra unemployment benefits through September 6th and up to $10,200 in tax relief for unemployed workers. Democratic leaders have also agreed to limit eligibility for that tax relief, restricting the tax-free status of the benefits to households with incomes under $150,000 a year. Now, the White House quickly announced its support after endorsing the earlier compromise. Jen Psaki releasing a statement last night saying, quote, "The president supports the compromise agreement and is grateful to all the senators who worked so hard to reach this outcome." Now, it is the Democrats plowing forward with the marathon, and it's been an all-night ordeal. At about 11 o'clock last night, Senator Bill Hagerty, Republican of Tennessee, stepped off the floor to speak with Fox News, and he sums up the Republicans' feelings about the COVID relief package.
After going through and reading the bill yesterday, and there was a lot of complaints from the Democrats about doing that, but Senator Johnson forced a reading of the bill. Now the American public knows what this really is. It's not a pandemic relief bill. This is a no-holds-barred pork barrel spending bill. There's more pork in this than all the barbecue joints in Tennessee combined. Less than 10% of this actually addresses the pandemic. Over 90% of this is basically a Democrat wish list that they're trying to jam through with a parliamentary trick and, again, bypass the normal committee process. That's why I put this motion in place to move it back into committee, get our arms back around this, and bring some control to the situation.
Well, it looks like it's going to pass. Now, here's yet another wrinkle in the mix. It was expected earlier that the vice president, Kamala Harris, would be needed to cast a tie-breaking vote. But the Republicans were down one member last night. Senator Dan Sullivan, the Republican senator from Alaska, had to fly back to his home state for his father-in-law's funeral. Now, assuming the bill passes at some point today, it will go back to the House, where lawmakers must approve the changes before it reaches Biden's desk. The goal of the Democrats is to have it all signed by the president by March 14th, which is when current benefits will expire. We'll keep an eye on it this morning. That's the latest. One note, social media ablaze after Kristen Sinema, the senator from Arizona, gave a thumbs-down gesture when she was voting on one of the amendments, and that was a thumbs-down gesture reminiscent of that thumbs-down from her predecessor, Senator John McCain, when he gave the thumbs-down on the Obamacare package that the Republicans were trying to upend at the time. A little bit of social media buzz in the wee hours of the morning. Well, we are at 6:14. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Lots to cover this morning. Obviously, you have seen the images of the border and the illegal crossings at the southern border. The Biden administration calling it a challenge. Many are calling it a crisis, but the Biden administration calls it a challenge. At least the Secretary of Homeland Security has called it simply a challenge. The criticism has gotten to the White House briefing room, and here's one of the questions that was posed to the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki yesterday about the border and about Trump policies.
The former president just released a statement saying that the Biden administration must act immediately to end the border nightmare that they have unleashed on our nation.
Former President Trump?
Yes.
We don't take our advice or counsel from former President Trump on immigration policy, which was not only inhumane, but ineffective over the last 4 years. We're going to chart our own path forward.
Ineffective? I'm not sure that's quite accurate. I think we all know how the numbers of illegal border crossings were drastically reduced under the Trump administration, and now they are going through the roof. Well, here's how Texas Senator John Cornyn summed it up.
I don't know whether it's the politics or just the incompetence of this administration. It seems to be the rule of thumb that that whatever Trump's policies were, you do the opposite, whether it makes sense or not.
Cheryl Atkinson will join us this morning. She has been at the southern border recently, and she will give us a real update on the impact on the state, the residents of the state, and the conditions. And we'll have a factual check from Cheryl Atkinson coming up this morning. We'll also talk with Tony Schaefer about the national security implications on the crisis at the southern border. And, yes, we will call it a crisis on the southern border. Well, there is a crisis for Governor Cuomo in New York. We'll get to that next. But first, let's check the traffic and weather. Albie D is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
Heads up in Centerville on 66 westbound. There is major road construction going on at 28, the Centerville exit, exit 52. Be sure to follow the detour around the construction. On 66 westbound in Centerville at 28, that off-ramp is closed. And in Merrifield on the outer loop of the Beltway at 66 exit 49, the right lane is blocked on that off-ramp from the outer loop to westbound 66. Only the left lane is getting by, and the traffic is jammed back to the Dulles Toll Road. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Well, we're looking for sunshine over the weekend, but it's going to be unseasonably chilly. Now, we should be up in the 60s this time of the year, and we're only going to be up in the 30s and 40s. So a crisp weekend in store for us here in the Washington area. And as we move forward in the week ahead, we're going to see some warmer temperatures toward the end of the week. But for the time being, it's going to remain chilly for today. Well, the high temperature only up about 45 this afternoon. For tomorrow, the high is 45. 50 for the highs on Monday. It warms up to 66 on Tuesday. And looking ahead to Wednesday and Thursday, look for highs in the 70s. We expect sunshine straight through, but it is a chilly 30 degrees in the nation's capital at 6:18.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. We are glad that you have joined us this morning. And as we mentioned, if you are just joining us, the Senate is still in session. They are working on the marathon COVID relief package. Looks like it will pass at some point today, but it has been a very long night for the senators on Capitol Hill. Now, it's been a very long week, and it will probably be a very long spring and summer for the New York governor, Andrew Cuomo, as he has run into some serious trouble with former aides and allegations from former aides. Charlotte Bennett is one of those who has come forward and talked about sexual harassment, and she has accused the governor. And we're going to go to a couple of sound bites that aired on the CBS Evening News on Thursday evening when Charlotte Bennett was talking with Nora O'Donnell. Charlotte Bennett, again, this is one of the accusers, and this is a former aide to Governor Cuomo. In the past, we've seen some allegations against some politicians, and often it comes from somebody from the other party. But keep in mind, as you hear the words of Charlotte Bennett, she is a former aide to Governor Cuomo.
He asked me if age difference mattered. He also explained that he was fine with anyone over 22.
And how old are you?
25.
What were you thinking as he's asking you these questions?
I thought he's trying to sleep with me. The governor's trying to sleep with me. And I'm deeply uncomfortable, and I have to get out of this room as soon as possible.
Now, the governor had a somewhat sloppy press conference, I'll call it sloppy, trying to clean up his mess, but in some sense dug it a little bit deeper. And Charlotte Bennett did see that press conference, and she had this to say to Nora O'Donnell on the CBS Evening News.
Without explicitly saying it, he implied to me that I was old enough for him and he was lonely.
Did you watch Governor Cuomo's apology?
I did. It's not an apology. It's not an issue of my feelings. It's an issue of his actions. The fact is that he was sexually harassing me and he has not apologized for sexually harassing me. And he can't even use my name.
How bad is it for Governor Cuomo? Let me read you a headline from CNN.com. New York Times and Wall Street Journal report top Cuomo aides rewrote nursing home report from state health officials to hide higher death toll. That's the second problem that Governor Cuomo has. The story goes on that some top aides for New York Democratic Governor Andrew Cuomo allegedly rewrote a June nursing home report from state officials to hide the higher COVID-19 death toll among the state's nursing home residents. That from the New York Times and Wall Street Journal reporting on Thursday night. In the New York Times report, it cites documents and interviews with six people with direct knowledge of the discussions who requested anonymity. Both the Times and the Wall Street Journal are reporting that some of Cuomo's senior aides were involved in rewriting the report to lower the death toll in nursing homes, cutting it by nearly half. Continuing with the CNN story, the controversy stems from a report last summer from the state's health department focusing on COVID deaths in long-term care facilities. The original report, which was not public at the time, listed the number of nursing home deaths at nearly 10,000, according to the Wall Street Journal. But it was later revealed in a state attorney general investigation that the state was not counting nursing home deaths if those people had been transferred to hospitals as their conditions worsened and died there. Beth Garvey, the governor's special counsel and senior advisor, said that, quote, out-of-facility data was omitted after the Department of Health could not confirm it had been adequately verified, end of quote. The alleged intervention by Cuomo's office in June is the earliest action currently known to delay the release of data of nursing home deaths and happened as the Democratic governor was starting to write a book about his experience leading New York through the COVID-19 pandemic. That from the New York Times. So when you have the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times digging into it, and that kind of coverage from CNN, you know the governor of New York has a hot mess on his hands. We've got more to cover on the Saturday morning update. We'll be talking, as I mentioned, with Cheryl Atkinson. We're also going to talk to Cheryl this morning about some interesting developments in the COVID-19 research, DNA research. And we haven't heard much about that. We've heard a lot about vaccines, but what is the role of DNA? We'll talk about that with Cheryl coming up this morning. As I mentioned, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer will talk about the issues down at the southern border. Very, very problematic there. John Gizzi is going to join us a bit later on this morning, and we'll talk with John about the Dr. Seuss situation. John's got some very interesting perspectives on the removal of six books of Dr. Seuss. The Dr. Seuss Foundation is no longer publishing the books. They have been removed from eBay, and it's caused quite a controversy. And very interesting perspectives on Dr. Seuss from John Gizzi, the history there of Dr. Seuss. I think you'll be surprised when you hear that. Also, we'll talk with John about an announcement from Mitch McConnell that he's been working on something that has caused a lot of buzz around Washington. And the question that John Gizzi asked at the press briefing yesterday of Press Secretary Jen Psaki, what about the State of the Union address? Well, we're going to talk about that with John, so stick around for that. We'll get KT McFarland's take on sort of the overview of all of the news as it relates to the Biden administration, as we always like to get that kind of bird's eye view from KT. And we'll talk with Jennifer Harper very shortly, and she's got some very interesting poll numbers on President Biden's performance. Jim Trusty joins us a little bit later on in this hour, and we will get the rundown from Jim on Governor Cuomo's legal exposure. I think you will find that very interesting. So we've got a lot to cover this morning, so do stay with us. It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I want to take a moment to acknowledge something that we did yesterday. And as you know, there's been a lot of controversy over the Emmy Award that Governor Cuomo received, the International Emmy Founders Award. Governor Cuomo, of course, for his role in his COVID-19 press conferences and things. So there's been a lot of talk about, will it be recalled? So I took a moment to send an email to the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and also the same email went to the International Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. And I wasn't expecting to get a response. I did get a response, and it's an interesting note here, and I just want to clarify, and I respected the fact that they got back with me on this. There are really two organizations here. It's if you go to the Emmy website, you will find that they have a sister organization to the National Academy, and the sister organization is the International Academy. So you go to the website, you'll find them on the one website, but they're two separate entities. And I wanted to read you the statement that I got from the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. It says, the International Emmy Founders Award was presented to Governor Andrew Cuomo by the International Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. The International Academy is a separate organization from the Television Academy, and all decisions regarding its annual Founders Award are its alone. Your inquiry should be directed to iemmys.tv in New York. Of course, that's the international group, and my original inquiry was directed there as well. We have not gotten a response from them, but I did appreciate a response from the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. It's 6:30 on WMAL. We'll check out the news in a minute. In the news at 6:30, the Senate continues its marathon to pass the president's $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. The Senate did reach a deal last night. There had been about a 9 to 10 hour delay as Senator Joe Manchin had delayed the compromise on unemployment insurance, but they finally did reach a compromise with Senator Manchin. The session continues. The vote is expected today, and it began yesterday at 11:03 a.m. on Friday morning. In other news, the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, says that despite the strong job gains last month, Congress still needs to, quote, go big by passing President Biden's $1.9 relief package. She says she wants to get people back to work sooner. The interview was on Friday. She said that Biden's package should not be trimmed just because the jobs report for Friday showed 379,000 new jobs had been created. California has cleared a path for fans to hit the stands at opening day baseball games and return to Disneyland. It's been nearly a year that coronavirus restrictions shuttered those major entertainment spots in California. The state yesterday relaxing guidelines for reopening outdoor venues as a fall and winter surge seemed to be ending in California. The infection rates and hospitalizations and deaths had plunged in California as vaccination rates are rising. 6:34, time for a check of the traffic and weather, and Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
In Alexandria on 395, the express lane southbound, there is construction. Left lane is closed at King Street. In Merrifield on the outer loop of the Beltway at 66, exit 49. Right lane is blocked on the off-ramp from the outer loop to westbound 66. Only the left is getting by. Traffic is jammed back to the Dulles Toll Road. In Silver Spring on Georgia Avenue southbound, utility work. Right lane is blocked to Bonneville Street. Also in Silver Spring on the Beltway outer loop, there is an accident between University Boulevard and Colesville Road. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Sunshine battles winds from the northwest, which will pick up for another gusty day. Starting wind chills in the 20s will only feel like the 30s this afternoon. Actual high temperatures will reach the mid and upper 40s. We'll be back down to the 20s tonight. Tomorrow you can expect highs in the mid 40s under more sunny skies and slightly calmer winds. We have a warming trend to look forward to next week with more spring-like temperatures. I'm ABC 7 meteorologist Rachel Kay with the Stormwatch 7 weather team.
30 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:35 on the Saturday morning update. It's the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper joining us every week. She writes inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
We all remember the access that President Trump gave to the media, whether it was press briefings, whether it was stopping to talk to the press on the way to the helicopter, the numerous radio and television interviews. In contrast, President Biden, 40-plus days in office without holding a full-blown news conference. And some people are kind of wondering if the president is hiding.
And a lot of people are noting this in a very careful way, because it's beginning to look like there's kind of a fine art of hiding Biden right now. A lot of journalists, news organizations, even the American public may be wondering, where is President Biden these days? And there's some history to that. There's kind of some habits going on there. In fact, here's a quote from 2019. This is coming from Vanity Fair. Is the Biden campaign trying to hide the real Joe Biden? A campaign based on nostalgia and name recognition may be masking more serious problems with the candidate himself. Again, that's coming from Vanity Fair in 2019. And the tone of this kind of thing is evolved. Let's look at the New York Times and what they had to say about this hidden Biden. And according to New York Times columnist Ezra Klein this week, he said, Joe Biden's approach, speak softly and carry a big agenda. If you can dial down the conflict, you can dial up the policy. Biden is the anti-Trump, and it's working. So they had something positive to say about that. Other people have a different opinion. In fact, there was a very lengthy discussion about this on Fox News this week. And Steve Doocy, he's the morning host, he said, Biden really has not been available. So he posed this question, asked for some insight from Kayleigh McEnany, and we all remember her as a former White House press secretary. She's now a Fox News contributor. Mr. Doocy said he recalled back in the day when Mr. Biden always seemed to be in his basement. So Mr. Doocy says, is it like the campaign where he's hiding in the basement? And so Ms. McEnany says, it's exactly like the campaign. That was a strategy all along, to hide in the basement, not talk with the American people. Then he gets to the White House and he hides in another figurative basement. But, you know, there are ways to cope with that these days. And Ms. McEnany herself and Fox News pointed to the current White House press secretary, Jen Psaki. And she was always advising reporters when they would pose a pertinent question that she would circle back and answer those questions at some other point. And we come up right against your comment there about the fact that former President Trump, when he was in office, he was always taking questions, whether he was on the White House lawn, in Air Force One, on a military runway, you know, just any place that the press had congregated. So Mrs. McEnany says, you know, I always knew where my boss stood. I always knew where his head was at. So I didn't have a ton of circling back because President Trump gave a lot of access to me. And that's kind of a teachable moment there for one and all, because, again, people are wondering, where is Mr. Biden?
And along these lines, I know you wrote a little bit about the history of press conferences at the White House.
Yes, you know, I'm always hung up on some history on some of these things. So I looked up, when was the first White House press conference? And believe it or not, it goes back to 1913. And the very first president to have himself a press conference was Woodrow Wilson. He was president from 1913 to 1921, and he staged the very first press conference in March 1913, and things did not go so well. So they had problems even back then. Now let's get to the problem here. Wilson's private secretary, whose name was Joseph Tumulty, he advised the press in Washington that at 12:45 p.m. on March 15th, 1913, the president would talk with them. The new president, he was expecting a small group. He wanted to greet each man one by one to foster a personal relationship. This is coming from an account in History News Network. This is a news site that's operated by George Washington University. Well, that small group, Rick, consisted of 125 reporters. So things were was not exactly what the president was expecting. And he told them, "I did not realize there were so many of you. Your numbers forced me to make a speech to you en masse instead of chatting with each of you as I had hoped to do, and thus getting greater pleasure and personal acquaintance out of this meeting." Again, that's what the president told this throng of reporters. And the New York Times later proclaimed that Wilson wins the newspaper men, and the press conference had arrived as a regular feature of presidential politics. So that's your little factoid of the day. 1913, first White House press conference.
Well, once we move out of the campaign polls, we move into the presidential approval polls. And what's the news for President Biden as to his approval ratings these days?
Yeah, I'm afraid the honeymoon is drifting out to sea here. And this is actually an academic poll. It's coming from Monmouth University. And they're very meticulous about their numbers. And it's kind of the honeymoon lasted about 40 days, not too long. And I have to remember, President Biden, he's been in office for 6 weeks and a couple of days. And his positive poll numbers, as you just mentioned, already eroding. Again, this is from the Monmouth University poll. In January, the university conducted a poll that found that 51% of the respondents said that the nation was on the wrong track. That percentage has now gone up to 61%. That's a pretty big leap. And another 54% said they approved of Mr. Biden's job performance in January. Now it stands at 51%, down by 3%. And that's a statistically, that's something to take note of. And more importantly, Rick, 30% of the respondents said they disapproved of Mr. Biden's job performance in that earlier poll. Now 42% say they disapprove. And according to Patrick Murray, he's the director of the Monmouth University Polling Institute, he says it's probably not a surprise that Biden's honeymoon has closed quickly. He does maintain a net positive rating, but the COVID stimulus package will be the first significant test of how stable that support is. So there's much to look at according to those numbers.
Well, here's a shocker. The New York Times actually had something positive to say about former President Trump.
Yeah, I couldn't believe this. This happened this week, and it's coming from New York Times columnist Thomas L. Friedman. And this is true. The great lady has actually published a little accolade of sorts. And here's what Mr. Friedman had to say. He said, "I was Googling around the other day for a factoid. How many Israelis had visited the United Arab Emirates since the signing of their normalization agreement, known as the Abraham Accords? The answer, more than 130,000. Jumpin' Jehoshaphat, Batman. In the middle of a global pandemic, at least 130,000 Israeli tourists and investors have flown to Dubai and Abu Dhabi since commercial air traffic was established in mid-October." Again, this is Mr. Thomas Friedman noting this. He credits Mr. Trump for, quote, reshaping the Middle East with the Abraham Accords. And as you know, that's a wide-ranging peace and normalization agreement between the U.S., Israel, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and some other nations that was formalized on September 15th. So anyway, Mr. Friedman says, I believe from the start that the openings between Israel and the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan, forged by Jared Kushner and Donald Trump, could be game-changing. We are still in the early phase, and having lived through the shotgun marriage and divorce of Israeli and Lebanese Christians in the 1980s, I will wait a bit before sending wedding gifts. That caveat aside, something big seems to be stirring. Unlike the peace breakthroughs between Israel and Egypt, Israel and Lebanon's Christian, and Israel and Jordan, which were driven from the top and largely confined there, the openings between Israel and the Gulf states, while initiated from the top to build an alliance against Iran, are now being driven even more from the bottom by tourists, students, and businesses. Again, coming from Thomas L. Friedman, he said Donald Trump was a game changer. Pretty good.
Millions of Americans are getting the COVID-19 vaccine, but there are those who will not get the vaccine. What are the numbers?
Yeah, well, people are pretty picky right now. This is coming from an Economist YouGov poll this week. 1,500 U.S. adults responded. Here's what they said. 38% of U.S. adults plan to get the COVID-19 vaccine when it becomes available to them. That includes 32% of Republicans, 30% of independents, and 53% of Democrats. 23% overall, Rick, do not plan to get the vaccine when it becomes available. That includes a third of Republicans, 27% of independents, and 12% of Democrats. 22% right now are not sure what the heck they're going to do. That includes 22% of Republicans, 29% of independents, and a third of Democrats. And finally, 16% overall say they've already been vaccinated. That includes 13% of Republicans, 15% of independents, and 22% of Democrats agree. And all those numbers say to me that this is still a work in progress, but it seems kind of hopeful. At least the feelings are shaking themselves out right now.
Jennifer Harper, inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. You can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Jennifer, thank you. It is 6:46. It is the Saturday morning update. We'll talk to Jim Trusty next. A lot of legal issues facing Governor Cuomo in New York, and we'll talk about it. But first, Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
I have a traffic update for you. You're going to start in Montgomery County. In Silver Spring on Georgia Avenue southbound, utility work. Right lane is blocked at Bonifant Street. Also in Silver Spring on the outer loop of the Beltway, there is an accident between University Boulevard and Colesville Road. In Merrifield on the Beltway, outer loop at 66, exit 49. Right lane is blocked on that off-ramp from the outer loop to westbound 66. Only the left lane is getting by, and the traffic is jammed back to the Dulles Toll Road. In Alexandria on 395 Express Lane southbound, there is road construction. Right lane is closed at King Street. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Sunshine battles winds from the northwest, which will pick up for another gusty day. Starting wind chills in the 20s will only feel like the 30s this afternoon. Actual high temperatures will reach the mid and upper 40s. We'll be back down to the 20s tonight. Tomorrow you can expect highs in the mid 40s under more sunny skies and slightly calmer winds. We have a warming trend to look forward to next week with more spring-like temperatures. I'm ABC7 meteorologist Rachel Kay with the Stormwatch 7 weather team.
It is a crisp 30 degrees in the nation's capital at 6:48 on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us each week. He is a partner at IFRA Law. He is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, always great to get your perspectives on the major legal stories of the day.
Thanks, and good morning.
The governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, is facing allegations of sexual harassment. Two from former aides, one from a woman that apparently he met at a wedding reception, put his hands on her face and made comments that she felt were inappropriate. Here are three women coming forward. It's not just one claim. It's not a vast right-wing conspiracy because two are former aides of the Democratic governor. What does the fact that there are three women coming forward at one time, what's that impact on the credibility of the women and the governor's defense?
Yeah, I think it has a pretty powerful impact in this particular situation. And you look at a number of things when it comes to, you know, sexual harassment or sexual assault claims. One is whether it's reported immediately, and that's not the issue that it used to be. I think people are more understanding than ever about the fact that various women don't want to necessarily take on high-powered political figures or executives, but you also look at kind of commonalities. Are there things that they seem to have in common with each other that give it some credibility? And, of course, as you touched on in terms of their politics, you look for any sort of blatant or obvious motive to fabricate. Well, there doesn't seem to be that here. You do have some details that are at least consistent. They're not in lockstep, but they're consistent with each other. And, you know, this is a really kind of controversial area of criminal law, typically, this issue of other crimes and how does it affect each individual victim or the case involving each individual victim. And, you know, I look at like Bill Cosby's case as an example of this. Bill Cosby, if you took one single complainant, one of the victims of Bill Cosby, and went to trial on that, it would be a very difficult case because they are talking about late reported, no physical corroboration, kind of he said, she said. What happened in Cosby's case really bears this out. As more and more people came out to say, no, this is what he did to me too, and the more distinctly similar the actions were, the more powerful the case became. And of course, at trial, or actually on a retrial, as they had about five other victims joining the single victim that was the basis of the charges, the case became extremely powerful. So, again, we're not in a criminal setting right now, but the same principle seems to hold here with Cuomo, that there's this accumulation of credibility that each one of the women gives each other at his expense.
If you were his defense attorney, how would you handle the changing story? We've seen it in the nursing home scandal, where the story coming out of the governor's office seems to change periodically. And we've seen how his tune has been changing here. First, it was a denial, and now it's a completely different story. If you were defending him, how do you deal with this just ever-changing narrative?
Yeah, first of all, you lock him in his room. You know, Cuomo came out the other day and said, well, my lawyer told me not to talk, but here I am. And my first thought was your lawyer was spot on. And there's a couple of dynamics that are kind of ruining his crisis management. And I guess they all tend to go back to the notion of ego. But the first thing is a lot of people that are high-powered political figures or very successful executives, and this is really male or female, they're so used to being treated as kind of philosopher kings that they think they're always going to persuade the other side. They just need one more chance in front of the microphone, and they're going to persuade everybody that they're right and that they didn't do anything wrong. So you have that starting point, I think, maybe on steroids with Cuomo, that he's pretty enamored with his Emmys, with his books, and with the microphones that he's had all through COVID, and thinks he can just talk himself out of it. The other thing is you have a lot of these folks, like in his situation, fighting a two-front war, one about the nursing home scandal and the other about sexual harassment, that's all they're thinking about. They're living and breathing this every second of the day. So by the time he gets to the microphone 24 hours later and changes his story, even by a little bit, he thinks he's still keeping up with the flood of news and the fight. But really, to everyone on the outside, they're like, oh, my God, he's coming back every single day with a new version. None of which is really a clean apology, but again, it erodes his credibility, and it's because he's looking inward and not letting somebody else handle the crisis management aspect of this.
This is an embarrassment to the governor. What about the criminal aspect of what you're hearing from the victims?
I think it's unlikely overall. I mean, the first thing is when you're talking about just kind of first-degree creepiness, where you're saying really inappropriate things, whether it's about sausage sandwiches or discussing prior sexual assaults. I mean, there's a lot of things that are pretty inexcusable moments for him, but they don't rise to the level of criminality. And then, of course, if it's been a while, there may be statute of limitations issues. I know one of the victims claimed that there was some unlawful touching or some fondling, and that usually has a two-year statute of limitations in New York, although there's an argument that it could be longer because of him being a public official. But bottom line is, I don't expect that these are really going to turn into a criminal prosecution. It would be very aggressive. It would probably require more evidence than we're hearing about publicly. What he's slowly admitting and what these women collectively seem to establish is a hostile workplace under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. I mean, he's all but confessed, you know, maybe tearfully and maybe narcissistically, but he's all but confessed that he created a hostile workplace, and that has civil liability but not criminal.
What is the governor's exposure on civil liability if he were to be sued by any of the accusers?
Yeah, they certainly have that option. I mean, we don't know the full extent of the evidence and corroboration, but, you know, if these are things that happened in under his watch as employees, even if it's not involving physical contact or quid pro quo, which was the original intent or discriminatory intent needed for a Title VII violation, the case law evolved to cover hostile workplace and these kind of creepy comments and repeated efforts by him to talk about personal things could easily fly. So, yeah, they had that possibility.
And in the situation where a female employee leaves that job because of the incident, does that lend more credibility to a civil case?
Yeah, it could add a claim of constructive discharge, meaning the only reason you left was because it was intolerable. But it also, no matter what the exact claim, could lead to additional damages. So, yeah, that's all in play. And I should just add, there's also a New York-specific statute in New York City called the Gender-Motivated Violence Protection Act that extends a lot of the civil remedies for sexual harassment in general or sexual assault. So there's another whole statute under a different regime that could kick into this as well if things were happening inside the city.
Jim, let's turn to the other major problem facing Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York. Headline at CNN, New York Times and Wall Street Journal report, top Cuomo aides rewrote nursing home report from state health officials to hide higher death toll. What's the significance of that development and everything else he's facing?
Well, I mean, the first thing is if Cuomo's lost CNN, goodbye. You know, that's a bad moment for him. But look, you know, this is the issue. I mean, when you are on top of any sort of organization and you direct people to engage in misconduct, which is what that allegation is, that he sent out his underlings to basically convince state officials to lie about the nursing home deaths, you know, that can work. You may have insulated yourself in kind of a conspiratorial way, and that's why conspiracies are difficult to break in the criminal setting because the leaders don't leave fingerprints. You know, they're not the ones that go out and commit the murder. They send somebody else to do it. Well, the problem with that is a conspiracy with other people doing your bidding is also where it's vulnerable. And what I think we're starting to see from the press accounts and from Ms. DeRosa's comments to Albany about how they were, you know, afraid of Trump and that's why they were cooking the books. I mean, that is the type of stuff that shows a conspiracy unraveling. And the folks that are in the middle of that, those underlings, are exactly in the perfect position to point upwards to Cuomo and say, yeah, I cooked those books, or I convinced the state officials to cook those books, and my boss told me to do that. If they can corroborate that with a text message or an email or just an accumulation of people saying the same thing, it's pretty devastating for Cuomo when it comes to obstruction of justice and false statements to the federal government, but also just for good old-fashioned moral culpability for what happened in these nursing homes.
The first aide to discuss this, which is sort of what started the snowball, was Melissa DeRosa. What does she do at this point to protect herself? Because obviously she's incurring legal fees.
Yeah, she sure as heck should have gotten a lawyer a little while ago, and I suspect she has one. I mean, look, I don't know all of the people that work for Cuomo, and, you know, there's probably a variety of people that could be in a position to hurt him with their testimony. But DeRosa seems to me a linchpin. I mean, keep your eye on her. If her attorney shows up publicly and starts talking about how they're working with the Eastern District of New York U.S. Attorney's Office, or if she stops showing up at events where she should be at Cuomo's side, he is going to be a very sweaty governor. I think she's exactly the kind of person that could bring him down just by herself.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. You can follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim, as always, thank you for your insight.
Sure, thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too. 7 o'clock news is next. Then we're back with John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Tony Schaefer, and Kate T. McFarland.
WMAL-FM Woodbridge, Washington. Now, more than ever, depend on 105.9 FM WMAL, a Cumulus station.